Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and tonight I'm proud to bring you retro sci-fi cinema with Brian Walker of Brian's Drive-In Theater. Greetings and welcome, Brian. How are you?
I am fine tonight, Hercules. How are you doing?
I'm fine. I'm looking forward to all the lore of George Powell that you're going to bring to us today.
Well, I hope I could deliver.
Okay. The song. The song from Rocky Horror that mentions George Powell kept playing in my head all day today in anticipation of tonight's show.
Oh, well, very good. Actually, you know, the idea for tonight's topic kind of came to me a couple of days ago. I was in my favorite video store, and fortunately, there's still one here somewhat locally. It's called Ides Entertainment, and it's in downtown Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going through the DVDs, and I picked up a couple of interesting drive-in titles, neither one of which I had ever seen before. And Ides also has a lot of vintage media, vintage posters, albums, you know, bits of other, you know, esoterica, you know, from films. And I stumbled upon three different press books. One is for Hercules and the Moon Men.
Oh, wow.
The second is for Hercules and the Captive Women. And the third is for the Trojan Horse. And
oh, wow.
And not that I have, you know, anywhere to put them, but I picked up all three. and I was really excited to get home and take a look at them. They're all differently sized,
mm-hmm.
Which I find very interesting. Usually a press book, at least the others that I have, almost exclusively, are 11 by 17. And the Trojan Horse press book is, you know, it's about 18 by 26 or something like that. So it's huge. It almost looks like a poster. And if you look at the front of the press book, it indeed looks like a poster, but so does the back of it. So it's really interesting, but it's just one big sheet. And when you open it up, of course, it has the reproduction material, you know, for anybody, you know, any theater that wanted to use it in the local magazine, or the local newspaper, or what have you there. One of them is cut up a little bit, but not too badly. The mm-hmm. Steve Reeves Trojan Horse has not been cut at all, which is great because it's just one big sheet. If it were cut, it would, you know, it would sort of cut into the images, you know, on the front and back.
Uh-huh.
And Hercules and the Moon Men is also, you know, pretty much basically intact. And I was really excited, you know, to get all three of them because, you know, I think collectors have picked over, you know, a lot of existing lobby cards, window cards, and
yes.
Movie posters. And when you can find, you know, something from, you know, some films that you really love or a particular genre that you like, it's almost like Christmas, which is,
right.
You know, we're just about a week out from that, as a matter of fact. And I guess in a way, those three press books, which were just a few dollars a piece, to tell you the truth, they didn't cost much. It was sort of a Christmas gift to myself, and I was really excited to get them.
Oh, that is awesome. I'm glad that you found them, and may you enjoy them from this point on. That is awesome.
Well, actually, I think I'm going to frame them and, you know, maybe reconfigure my den, try to work them in, you know, somehow, because they're not in bad shape. They're certainly not mint, you know, however. But, you know, if you frame them, you know, fairly nicely and, you know, from 5 feet away, I think they'll look just fine as long as you don't get too close to them. I love going into stores where they still sell physical media. You know, we've talked about this a million times, you know, the DVDs and such. And, you know, it's Christmas time, and it's a time of giving, and you want to support, you know, the businesses that you like, the ones that you know, come to trust. And this probably sounds more altruistic than it was, but I thought, you know what, if you think about it this way, if I don't go out and support this business that I really like, it's not going to be there for me much longer.
Very, very true, especially now.
And you know,
yes,
exactly. And and I was also going to be in the Pittsburgh area, so it wasn't as if I made a special trip just to go to Hyde's Entertainment. But you know, I could have passed it by, but certainly didn't want to. And I was rewarded with those three press books.
And what a reward! That is incredibly awesome.
And, you know, as I was going through the DVDs at Ides, I saw a couple of titles that jumped out at me that I, you know, movies that I hadn't seen before and ones that, you know, really fit for tonight's topic. So I went ahead and picked them up. the one I watched last night, which is Antonio Margheriti's Cannibal Apocalypse, also known as Cannibals in the Street. It's a really interesting take on, you know, cannibalism movies were actually somewhat of a subgenre in the late 70s and early 80s, you know, especially, you know, in European cinema. I guess it was supposed to be in some sort of perverse way exotic. This movie by Antonio Margheriti, who did a ton of films, he did some really interesting science fiction films, is one that I hadn't seen before. So I was excited. I was excited to watch it. The cast is really good. It's headed up by John Saxon, the American actor who passed away, you know, just months ago. And his movies are always watchable, and they're most often B movies at that. But you know, a very watchable film, and it's got a very interesting twist. It's sort of across. The cannibals are also, in a sense, zombies at the same time, and they're created by a virus that can be, you know, transmitted from one person to another. And it has to come by way of a scratch, some sort of blood-to-blood contact, almost like AIDS. And, you know, it's sort of interesting that, you know, this film came out in 1980, you know, just as, you know, AIDS began ramping up in the United States. I think, you know, common lore suggests that it entered the U.S. on, I believe it was July 4th, 1980. I don't know if that's really true, but that's sort of the way it's been staged and claimed by, you know, a number of people. And it's just interesting that, you know, the take on cannibalism and zombies in Cannibal Apocalypse sort of mirrors, in a sense, what was actually going on. It's almost prophetic. It's kind of eerie. And there have been several other zombie movies that sort of treat the state of being a zombie as the result of, you know, some sort of infection or a virus or something like that. So, you know, these movies are old, but, you know, in a way they're still, you know, pretty topical. And Cannibal Apocalypse, it's extremely, like any Italian science fiction or horror film, it's extremely graphic. they don't spare the blood, you know, in it. And it's without, you know, throwing out too many spoilers there, there's this big twist in the middle of the film.
It's right in
the middle of the film, and you know, you're rooting for the protagonist, and all of a sudden, the protagonist, you know, sort of morphs into a bad guy. But interestingly, I found myself still rooting for the protagonist, even though, you know, he was once good and is now bad. And it's a twist like that, that, you know, at the end of the film, I really started thinking, gosh, was I rooting for the zombies that are eating people? it was an odd take on it. Now, at the end of the film, the director makes everything right and makes sure that the, you know, the zombies, as they were portrayed, all, you know, suffer some sort of, you know, tragic end. But of course, you know, the door is left open, you know, for, you know, any potential sequel or something like that. But it was a fun movie to watch, and I really like this director's films.
Mm-hmm.
We've actually talked about him before. He is responsible for, you know, some great mid-60s science fiction films like The Wild Wild Planet and War of the Planets. Both of those movies were pretty much shot back-to-back with the same cast, and a lot of the set pieces between the two movies appear to have been shared. So I guess it was a sort of a two-for-one in that respect. But he did. Did you ever see Your Hunter from the Future?
Yes, I love that movie.
I do too. And apparently, liking that movie is somewhat controversial. If you read, I remember seeing it. I think the first time I saw it was probably early '80s on HBO. I think it did make the rounds on HBO at the time, and it stars Reb Brown, you know, one of my favorite actors, you know, who's done a ton of films over the years, and it's just a fun title to watch, and that's also a film that was directed by Antonio Margheriti. So I like what he does with science fiction. Mm-hmm. You know, in his earlier films, is especially if it's done with any, if there's any kind of space exploration or anything like that, it's done very straightforward. But the movies are very stylish. He has very interesting use of color, and if you squint just right, you can't. The models look really good whenever whenever they're showing us a spaceship or something like that. You know, these movies were made on a budget, and there's no way they could have possibly, you know, built any scale models, you know, of a spaceship or anything like that. But like I said, you know, if you were seeing it, you know, in a typical print at a grindhouse or a drive-in, you probably couldn't tell. Well, maybe you could tell that they were models, but it would have looked a lot better. Yeah. You know, the copies, I'm watching Wild Wild Planet right now. You know, the copy quality is so good that you can see some streams and things like that, you know, here and there. But it's still, you know, a very engaging movie. And if you can, you know, suspend your disbelief for 90 minutes, his films, Margheriti's films, are a lot of fun.
I have to seek some out and watch them. It sounds like a lot of fun.
Well, and, you know, you probably have seen some. I mean, just mentioning Your Hunter from the Future, for example, which was one of his movies. But he's done some others as well. He did a really interesting, and I know we're not talking about spaghetti westerns tonight, but he did a really interesting spaghetti western in the mid-19th. Well, he uses primarily African-American cast. It's headed up by Jim Brown and Fred Williamson and Jim Kelly. But it's a spaghetti western, and true to form, Lee Van Cleef is in it as well, who must have been in his contract to be in every spaghetti western. If you look through his filmography, I mean, they're thick. But, you know, it makes the film fun, and, you know, you almost do have to have Lee Van Cleef, you know, if you are going to be doing a spaghetti western. Now, Margheriti also did some of your favorite films. He did Hercules, Prisoner of Evil. He directed that with Reg Park. Devil of the Desert Against the Son of Hercules. He's done some Eurospy stuff, such as Lightning Bolt, that has another one of my favorite actors in it, who's Anthony Isley, who was on Hawaiian Eye in the early 60s and did a lot of B-movies. I really encourage anybody, if you're interested primarily in Italian horror and science fiction, to look this director up. And he sort of appeals to a lot of different cults within horror and science fiction. I'm sure you know who Barbara Steele is, the British actress who appeared in a lot of 1960s Italian horror films. He directed, I believe, two or three of the films that she did. He worked in the peplum genre. I just mentioned the spaghetti western that he made with Jim Brown. And he did a lot of science fiction. That's probably as much as any other genre. I would say he put more time into horror and science fiction than some of the others throughout his career. Your Hunter from the Future was one of his later films, although he did make a few more into the mid 1980s. He passed away in 2002. His films are really fun to watch in terms to see what he does with science fiction and how, his view of it sort of changes over time. He starts out doing pretty much stock, sci-fi, space exploration, humans against aliens type thing. But as his career progressed, and as time marched on, Your Hunter from the Future, for example, is science fiction, but it's sort of, a prehistoric, post-apocalyptic film.
It defines civilization. I remember when I first saw it, it's like, is this a caveman movie? Is it a post-apocalyptic movie? Is it, what exactly is it, science fiction? It combined everything in a very unique and distinct way.
See, my take on it, and I could be 100% wrong, but my take on Your Hunter from the Future is that it is post-apocalyptic, but somehow in the future, but the past. at the same time, it's really hard to explain. And, the copy that we see in America of Yore is actually a really edited down version of the film. And it doesn't always seem to make, there's some leaps, from one scene to another. And I think it's just because it was edited maybe a little too severely. Another 20 or 30 minutes of exposition, might make it, a little more understandable. On the other hand, the first time I saw it, I was so intrigued by it that I probably did watch it four or five more times to try to figure out exactly what was going on. And maybe that's its brilliance, is that parts of it are kind of obtuse because they're missing, so it kind of demands a second viewing, if not a third or a fourth.
Yeah, I like those movies that kind of defy a categorization. There was one movie, I'm trying to remember the title of it, and I can't at this point. It was another, I believe, an Italian low-budget movie, and it had this naked woman with a golden mask, and she was the leader of a bunch of werewolves. And it started out with this guy who was like a demigod, and he had a magic bow. And then there was another guy who was like a caveman barbarian. And then somehow the plot that they started with, at one point in the movie, they abandoned it totally. And it became about the secondary character. And I'm trying to remember, I don't remember what it was called, but it's one of my favorite Defy Categorization movies.
And I like it when a movie isn't so stock and standard that, you know, it's so linear from beginning to end that there really are no surprises. There's no guessing on your part trying to figure out what's going on. And fortunately, you know, with Italian horror and Italian science fiction, there's a, you know, a twist at every curve. You can't really expect any character to be alive 5 minutes from now. Sometimes even the protagonist will die like midway, into a particular film. And I like that these films do sort of, you always keep you guessing. They're not really, I guess they're, what I really mean to say is that they're not really that predictable, and that's
right.
Sort of the fun part of them, you know, and every once in a while, the protagonist will die, or the antagonist is the one who gets to live, which I think is even better, and really probably mimics real life more than anything else. To tell you the truth, but there again, he's a really good director. Never made anything with any kind of a budget, but that's okay. It makes you inventive.
Mm-hmm.
And much in the tradition of, you know, a lot of European directors who were making films for the world market, he often drew people, different actors. From different cultures, oftentimes, but not always, he'll have like a male lead who is British or American, you know, a name that somebody might, that you might recognize, you know, if you're walking past a marquee and you see a name. But he'll also pick, people from, European cinema. And he also seems to have a sort of a repertoire of actors that he, puts in every film. And these people might only be in one or two scenes or something like that, but you can see them, in so many of the films that he makes. So it's kind of nice to see some familiarity along with, in the cast. And it's also nice to, try to figure out, which, fairly well-known actor or actress that he's going to put in his films.
Right. Those were a treat. Have you ever done any role-playing like Dungeons and Dragons type of stuff?
I have. It's been a long time ago, but that was something that I enjoyed doing in college when I was a freshman.
These movies lent themselves to either generating or being included in all sorts of campaigns I used to run. So the stranger the movie, the better. It used to wind up in there, especially the sword and sorcery movies. And You're the Hunter was, of course, included there. But the characters, the situations, they were phenomenal things to integrate into campaigns.
Yeah, and that's a really good point to make. I never would have drawn that conclusion out.
And some of them, like Deathstalker and Ator, were series. Deathstalker had different Deathstalkers, and they were very different from each other. One of the movies was even a comedy, which I greatly enjoy, the second one. And then there was Ator that had all sorts of bizarre exposition, and weird prophecies. And they had somebody with a spider tattoo, I believe, that moved around a bit. They didn't put it in the same spot. So every time you saw this guy with a spider tattoo, it was situated slightly differently on his head.
Well, after thinking about Antonio Margheriti, I started thinking about what came before him, and potentially who might have inspired him in his science fiction films. And, you know, the films of George Pal sort of set the stage for space exploration and science fiction. You know, even though he started this 70 years ago, it's a lot of the visual is still goes back to him, and still goes back to the films that he did in the 1950s and 60s. And the cinematography and the special effects that he used, I think, especially at the time, looked so good on screen. Maybe not cutting edge. I mean, they weren't technologically difficult to pull off or anything like that, but they were done very well. He used a lot of animation because he started off, as an animator. And when he was making his films in the 1950s and 1960s, animation was one way to make a smaller budget movie look perhaps to be of a bigger budget. And I pulled out my copy of Destination Moon and watched it today, as a matter of fact. And that was Pal's second feature film, but really his first science fiction movie. And in viewing it, it was released in 1950. He shot his films in color. He was not a fan of black and white, and it really makes a difference, especially in those science fiction films that he shot in the 50s. Oftentimes the look of the movie, it was a little bit like Stanley Kubrick in that the look of the movie sort of drove everything else in the film. And, what was going on screen, the exposition, the drama, the byplay between cast members sort of took a back seat in a way to, the space scenes and what outer space looked like. Which it's a very interesting thing to think that he was doing these movies before, we ever landed, someone on the moon, for example. Destination Moon came out in 1950. The moon landing didn't occur until 1969. And going back in to look at his films, actually he did a pretty good job at predicting the technology and what it would look like, the needs of people, what atmosphere would be like, on the moon. It's interesting. He really did his homework on it. Now he wasn't really directing these movies. He was just a producer. I shouldn't say just a producer, but he was producing these movies. Typically, he would work with like a pool of different directors. Although a little later in his career, he did, sit in the director's chair for a few films. But for his early ones, he acted as producer. He had done, he was Hungarian, and he was born to parents who were stage actors in Hungary. Apparently, he didn't have the will or desire to be a stage actor, but he was a very good artist. He could draw very well. And after graduating from college, he got interested in animation and started working for a studio in Hungary, and then moved to Germany because it was more lucrative to work in German studios doing some graphics for films. He started moving into cartoon animation, stop motion animation, I guess I probably should say, which he became very good at. And when he immigrated to the U.S. around 1940, his work was recognized almost the second he got off the boat, and started working as an animator. And if you take a look at the animated shorts that he does that he did in the 1940s, there again they're all done in color, and they're all done painstakingly with stop motion animation. Even though they were just short, maybe 5-6 minutes long, you can kind of see where his career, how that took his career in the direction of science fiction. Because they do have a certain look and a certain feel to them that, if you watch them, they almost do feel, like science fiction in a way. Probably the most famous one of the shorts that he did was Tubby the Tuba. I think of all of them, that's probably the one that most people have seen. And it's very creative, very inventive. And several of his shorts were given quite a few accolades in the 40s when they were released, because they were so cutting edge and innovative and different. They did have a look that nobody else really had. The visual was so much different from the output of everybody else. And I listened to, I found some interesting information, about George Pal on, of all things, YouTube. And I found an audio recording that he had done about 50 years ago. It sounds like to me that he's in a college classroom or at some sort of institute or Comic-Con or something like that. And he's talking about his career, but he's also being posed questions by different people in the audience.
Okay.
And it's interesting. It's interesting to hear on what some of his influences were, and what he created, and who might have been influenced by that as well.
Now, George Powell, that's a name that is familiar to a lot of people, especially if they're into science fiction movies. Are there any people who he inspired that went on to accomplish memorable things in the science fiction genre?
Well, if you compare, and this was the movie of the day just a couple of days ago, Conquest of Space. That was a movie of the day, I believe, yesterday, as a matter of fact, with Eric Fleming, one of the lead actors from Rawhide. If you look at the spaceship shots in that movie, you can compare them to Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey. Now, Kubrick's film benefits from the advancements in technology, and certainly a budget that was many times greater than anything George Pal ever had to work with. But if you look, I mean, the spaceship shots are so similar, and it's really amazing what Pal was able to do, with a far more limited budget and technology that wasn't necessarily all that cutting edge.
Mm-hmm.
But came out with something that really looked similar to it. Now, Kubrick's film is beautiful. In terms of cinematography and use of color and lighting, 2001: A Space Odyssey is a masterpiece alone. If you just look at those elements of the film. And I don't have confirmation on this or anything, but Kubrick had to have seen, he had to have been influenced by Pal's films, because Pal sort of set the stage for what all that was supposed to look like.
Mm. Was he well-read? Did he love science, or was he just a deep thinker?
George Pal, he seemed to be interested in the look of it more than anything else. Like I said, he was an artist, he was an illustrator. As an artist, you have to work on the background. You have to populate that background, and your plot, your actors, they're the ones populating the background. But I don't mean to say that he wasn't interested in the narrative at all, but I do think that for him, the overall look of it was probably more important, you know, than the storyline or the narrative or what was going on. But, you know, he had limited resources, and, you know, when you're spending money on a film, you have to make choices, right?
Yeah.
And if you want it to look futuristic, and if you want it to look space age, and you want to impress, you're probably going to put that money, you know, into that aspect of the production, you know, the sets, and any of the special effects or animation used. He often worked with Walter Lantz, who was the creator of Woody Woodpecker, you know, the cartoon character.
Mm-hmm.
And Walter Lantz worked on numerous George Pal films. And as I was watching Destination Moon this morning, I had forgotten that there's a sequence in the film. It's about a 5-minute sequence that features Woody Woodpecker.
Oh, wow.
And I had completely forgotten about that. And as I was doing research on that, I found that Walter Lantz was sort of instrumental in helping George Pal immigrate to the United States and in becoming a citizen. He sort of acted as his sponsor.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I had no idea that there was, you know, any link like that, you know, between the two. I mean, they were both animators, you know, of course. And I can only imagine that Walter Lantz probably saw some of George Pal's output and was really impressed by it.
That is an odd piece of trivia. Thank you.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm here for. You know, interestingly, Pal's films, you know, when they were being released, weren't always big hits. We tend to think of him, you know, today as, you know, a pioneer, you know, somebody who set the stage for science fiction films. Even the ones today that we're watching, you know, still have bits and pieces and elements of the films that he did, you know, 70 years ago. But his films weren't necessarily always all that popular. He started out with Eagle Lion films in America when he was beginning to move into feature films. And Eagle Lion was a brand new studio of sorts. Kind of came about from the J. Arthur Rank of the Rank organization, who was sort of the British Jack Warner. He wanted to make films in Britain for American audiences. And this is like immediately post-World War II, like mid to late 40s. So he, you know, created this new studio called Eagle Lion. He bought Producers Releasing Corporation, otherwise known as PRC. And PRC had been this Poverty Row, you know, B-movie studio that turned out a lot of films, especially during the war years in the early 40s. And PRC usually used like a big-name horror actor. Bela Lugosi, for example, was in a lot of PRC films. And Lionel Atwell was in a few. J. Arthur Rank bought PRC and then, you know, sort of renamed it Eagle Lion. And it was his idea to hire independent producers to make films. And that's sort of where George Pal gets his start. And he signed a contract with Eagle Lion, but he only made two films for them. The first one, I should say, It's kind of a neat film and is not really science fiction at all, exactly. But it's more along the lines of fantasy. And it's called The Great Rupert. It's a comedy, and it has one of my favorite actresses in it, Terry Moore, who fortunately is still with us at the age of 91. And Jimmy Durante is the headliner in it. It's kind of an interesting film. It's kind of an interesting film, you know, for George Powell, because it's really a Christmas movie, you know, to tell you the truth, because it's about Jimmy Durante's family, and it's Christmas time, and they're down on their luck, and they don't have any money, and it's a very heartwarming film, but not science fiction. And, you know, the film did okay at the box office. It wasn't like a huge hit or anything like that. But it did give him, you know, the clout, you know, the impetus you know, to move into more science fiction works.
So, and these films, are they available, like easily obtainable these days?
Fortunately, you know, most of them are. He did the Destination Moon. I did find, this is something that I found interesting. My copy of Destination Moon is the 50th anniversary edition. It says so right on the DVD jacket. Well, you know, that movie came out in 1950, and I started thinking about it. And I thought, you know, gosh, this DVD probably is about 20 years old. I probably did buy it around 2000, 2001. And, you know, the copy of it that I was, my copy of it, you know, it's got some negative scratches here and there. I mean, the color looks good. I mean, it's not a bad print, but it's not a perfect print. It clearly has not been restored. So I thought, you know what, I bet this is on Blu-ray. This would look fantastic, you know, on Blu-ray. I'm going to check it out on Amazon's site. And I got into Amazon's site, and there are only two versions of that film that you can buy. You can buy the old VHS tape, which I believe they had priced at $19 for VHS. So that's
wow,
pretty valuable. Yeah. And the copy of the DVD that I have, the 20th anniversary edition, if you can find a new copy of it, is $37. Unfortunately,
wow,
there's nobody has, you know, stepped forward to try to restore it. You know, the copy of it that I have, like I said, it doesn't look bad by any means, but it certainly isn't as crisp or as sharp as it really should be. I think that would be a fantastic viewing experience to see that restored. But those are the only two copies that are available, and I don't know why it's not, it hasn't been, you know, selected, you know, for restoration. I don't know if it's a rights issue, which I suppose could be possible. Since it was distributed by Eagle Lion. Eagle Lion didn't last very long. They were out of business by 1951.
Uh-huh.
The films that they had were, the rights were sort of bought and sold several times. So it's difficult to know really who ended up with the rights to it. I suspect that's probably the problem there, why it hasn't been you sort of given a restoration treatment like some of Powell's other films. I mean, he did War of the Worlds, which is that's sort of the seminal science fiction film from the 1950s. It's beautifully done. And you know, when it comes to the way the film looks and the way the technology is portrayed that the aliens have, I mean, it's a terrifying film. It's one of those science fiction films that has so many elements of horror in it that it's genuinely frightening. It's as frightening as any monster movie that you're ever going to see. But you know, the aliens themselves are more they're not really monsters. You know, they're sort of bits of technology. You know, essentially. War of the Worlds is just a brilliant movie, and you can get, you know, there's a Criterion Collection version of it, which is the one I have. You know, thank goodness. I pulled that out today as well and popped it in and just sort of got sucked into it because, you know, it's such a good film.
Mm-hmm.
And he also did When Worlds Collide, which is another great film. Occasionally pops up on Turner Classic Movies. And it's sort of an apocalyptic, you know, our time on Earth is going to land. So, you know, we're going to, you know, pick the best and the brightest and send them away somewhere else so they can, you know, repopulate, another planet. And another great film, as a matter of fact, that George Pal did. He, like I said, he produced films more so than directed. He did direct a few things here or there, that he produced. He produced and directed The Time Machine, the H.G. Wells story with Rod Taylor and Yvette Mimeo. There again, it's another one that you see pretty often on Turner. Yeah, it's a fun movie. It really is. And he did another movie that pops up a lot called The Seven Faces of Dr. Lau with Tony Randall.
I remember that.
And that was the last film that he directed. I guess, you know, it's being a producer of a film or a director of a film is so much work. It's very difficult. And trying to do both at the same time is just that's a recipe for a heart attack, if you ask me. And it probably just got to be, you know, too much to try to do it. And then he went back to, you know, using in his last couple of movies, because he only did two films beyond the Seven Faces of Dr. Lau. He did that George Hamilton movie, which is really interesting. Unfortunately, it was a box office failure called The Power. I don't know if you've seen it or not.
It's ringing a bell, but I don't recall very much about it. I remember seeing it, but I don't remember much about it.
It's an interesting science fiction film. George Hamilton is the star of the movie, and he's part of this governmental research team involving telekinesis and, you know, sort of being able to affect your physical surroundings, but just using your mental abilities, not actually physically touching something, but, you know, using your mind in order to, you know, change your surroundings. And it's a really interesting premise for a film. And I actually, you know, having seen it a couple of times, it's very well done. The cast is fantastic. It's George Hamilton is in it, Yvonne DiCarlo, Suzanne Plachette, another science fiction veteran, Richard Carlson, is in it. Aldo Ray, and even Barbara Nichols, another one of my favorite actresses, makes an appearance in it as well. It's a shame that it didn't do all that well. He only did one other film past this, and that was the Ron Ely Doc Savage film from the mid-1970s.
I remember that. They were going to do a series of them, if I recall correctly, but they just made the first film.
Right. And, you know, there again, I think Doc Savage wasn't a failure, but it wasn't the giant success that it would need to have been in order to, you know, move forward, you know, with a series. And that's probably really what got in the way, I would say. You know, and like I said, Powell's films, while, you know, revered today and very well remembered, weren't always big hits, you know, when they were released. And that's probably, the part of his legacy that's maybe the hardest to understand is that you going back to look at these films, I mean, they're beautiful films. They're wonderfully photographed. They're very interesting as well. Some of the early ones, you know, the plots are simple but straightforward, very engaging. And as he moved through his career, much like Antonio Margheriti, the plots became more complex. You would either even see a plot twist here or there in the films and so forth, to keep you going, to keep you interested. And really, I mean, the definition of a good movie for anybody is probably going to be a little bit different. But for me, a good movie is one that keeps my attention from beginning to end. It's one that grabs me from, the opening credits and takes me all the way through to the end. I'm sorry?
That's a good definition.
No, it is for me. And in that respect, that it doesn't have to be a big budget. It doesn't have to have, big name actors. It doesn't have to have actors I've ever heard of in it. As long as it's engaging, as long as it reaches out and grabs me, if it forces me to pay attention, and my attention span these days is pretty short, I got to admit.
Mine too.
And a movie really has to reach out and grab me. And I think you'll know what I'm talking about as well. I've seen so many of them at this point that, if it smells or tastes like five other movies that I've seen, I'm probably not going to be interested in it. But, if it does have a hook, if it does sort of have that opening, the scene one that reaches out and grabs you or that shocks you or terrifies you, you're going to want to keep watching it.
Most certainly so. And like you recently, I've been taking advantage of the dollar movies that are in Dollar General and other places. And some of them, after 10, 15 minutes, I just turn them off, or switch them. But some of them have been really good and have grabbed me, as you describe, and kept me for the whole 90 minutes or so. So they became keepers.
And I think I told you this last week, but I finally did buy a copy of Tim Burton's Dark Shadows, which I picked up at the Dollar General, as a matter of fact, in Grantsville, Maryland. It's Blu-ray and it's only $5. I have not unwrapped it yet. It's still in the shrink wrap. But I am going to try to, watch it, over the holiday season. I'm working from home, until about the middle of January or so. So I'm hoping that I'll have a little bit more time, so I can devote a couple of hours to watching it.
I look forward to your thoughts on it. For me, it was fun. I enjoyed it. I tried watching the original Dark Shadows, which I was very, very into as a kid. And I just, some of them were unwatchable. And I enjoyed the Ben Cross version that they did, the remake. The first movie,
right.
Not so much the second movie, even though I like the character of Quentin more than Barnabas in the original series. So I consider myself a Dark Shadows fan, and my wife, Athena, she was part of the Collinswood Players, the Collinswood Players. So she used to skits at the Dark Shadows conventions. So we both enjoyed the Tim Burton version. It was very irreverent, and it was very enjoyable.
Well, I'm a big fan of the old TV series, and it's so much so that I have, gone back, fairly within the last 4 or 5 years, and watched the first 3 seasons, of the soap opera, and I love it. Now, I know that a lot of the dialogue is kind of stilted. It almost sounds like it was written in the 1930s, in a sense. But the actors, there's a lot of buy-in from them. You can tell they're trying their best. And even if there is a gaffe, you know, if one of the production assistants is walking by and they're shooting a scene and they don't miss a beat. They just let it happen. It's very reminiscent of old live television, which is just something that doesn't really seem to exist anymore. I mean, everything, even the stuff that's live is on a delay.
Yes.
You know, even if it's just a few seconds. But back then, live was live. So whatever happened. And it's kind of the fun of that. And I'm a big Joan Bennett fan.
Yes.
I love it. She made some great film noir movies. And, you know, just seeing her pop up on this gothic soap opera is just amazing. And she's always a presence no matter what. She does flubber lines here and there, yeah, but still, you know, a lot of fun. I love that series so much. That's why I was afraid of the Tim Burton version. I was afraid I would just be disgusted, but I will approach it with an open mind. And I love Johnny Depp, and I love Tim Burton for that matter.
Unfortunately, we've run out of time for our conversation today, but I definitely want to, when you watch the movie, I'd love to focus on that. And we can even do a tribute to Dark Shadows, if you like, on one of the shows.
That would be a lot of fun.
Thank you so very much. I enjoyed our conversation as I enjoy all our conversations. I wish you and your partner and your family and your friends a very happy holiday and a joyous new year.
Well, and happy new year to you, Athena and Theosophia.
Thank you very much. I will talk to you soon.
Thank you, Hercules. Good night.
Good night, and thanks to everybody who's joined us, whether you joined us live as we were talking or you're going to tune in later on demand. I wish you happy holidays and a joyous New Year as well. We're going to close with If You Can Dream by Virginia Ackley, as we often do.
If you can dream, if you can fly, then your heart can touch the sky, but only if you can dream. If love is true and love is real, pain and sorrow soon will heal, but only if you can dream. Dream till you wake, dream till you feel, dream till you know it, dream till it's real. If you can dream, then you can be bound by love and yet be free, but only if you can dream. When love and trust are deep and fair, there is nothing your heart won't dare, but only if you can dream. Dream till you wake, dream till you feel, dream till you know it, dream till it's real, dream till you feel. till it's reached.